Good morning and welcome. God bless each one of you in your life. Thank you for sharing, Jason. And I'm thinking he may do better than I do. I find it interesting. There's probably no way to become more aware of how often you mess up in saying things than if you spend some time talking in front of a bunch of other people. So I guess that's where hopefully God can at least use that to create humility in my life that can be positive. So I thought of it when you said that, and I thought, well, he just said the name wrong, which is what I do, so no problem there at all. In fact, sort of a little bit different. I think it's probably worse in some ways. In the last message I'd shared, and I shared a little bit about some of the feedback we receive as a family. I'm not going into that much. But I had a brother that wasn't sure that I said that in the right spirit. So if I said that at, yeah. I don't know, in some ways I'm a person that I guess I tend to speak my mind a little bit, whether for good or ill, and where that's ill, I'm sorry. So yeah, continue to pray for me in that. Also, before I get in the message, just for openness, accountability, Thursday night we fly to actually Hungary, Budapest. From there we'll be traveling to Germany to spend the weekend and for those of you that met Jakob here, it'd be with his groups, sort of even an evangelical Mennonite setting. They moved, most of those, I think, came out of Russia at some point. And then from there, by Wednesday, we need to be at Romania. And we'll be sharing in Romania from Wednesday night through Sunday morning. And then we fly back home Tuesday. So I'd be glad for your prayers and support, however, yeah, as that crosses your mind. Pray for us. And also, yeah, maybe especially, I don't know that there's really nothing official, and I don't really intend to make any statement about this, but part of the, after I was asked to go to Romania and share, then they came back around and said, we'd like if you'd think about living there. So, it's like I said, there's nothing really discussed on it or anything. I just thought you'd pray for us in that too. Okay, so back to the message this morning. How many wise people are here? So are you just so humble that you would not admit to it, or do you really think you're not wise? That's a tough question. So it might be a safer question. I don't know. You have to raise your hands on this one either. But is how many of you would like to be wise? Is that something you've ever thought? Use some wisdom. I think it periodically. Sometimes it depends. Sometimes I'm quite content with the wisdom I think I have. Then I realize how foolish my wisdom is, and I think maybe I should have more real wisdom. But that's something that's a little bit more easier to say. It made me think of the verse in James 1, verse 5. It says, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God that giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not. In other words, he doesn't mock us for our need. And to me, that's precious, that because, especially at those moments when I feel desperately in need of wisdom, to know that I can go ask God. And he's not going to in Dutch sput me because I don't have what I need. And he giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not. So here's the next question is, if I lack wisdom, is it just, in other words, is getting or, yeah, having wisdom as simple as asking in faith and mission is accomplished? Is that all it takes? Because I'm pretty sure I've asked God different times to help me. So why do I still sometimes have these limitations in wisdom? Maybe we'll answer a few of those questions as we go through. So my title this morning, actually before I give you that, I'd like to talk of wisdom, and that's the one word. So one question for you, if you were to give me or paint a picture of wisdom for me, what would it look like? Can y'all just help me out a little bit? If you were to give or paint a picture of wisdom, what would it look like, just briefly? Okay, a grandpa talking to his grandson. I thought a little bit of an older wise-looking man talking or sharing. Okay, thank you. Any more? Do you have any other mental images of wisdom? What does wisdom look like? Does wisdom have a face in your life, in your book? Solomon. So how did he look? That's fine. So Solomon, yeah, definitely. Any other mental images of wisdom? Okay, the Bible. Thank you. Okay, Christ. So we're getting a lot of different facets of wisdom here. Thank you all for that. I find it interesting, one of the books that was brought up as something to study, Proverbs, so I guess it's a good thing I had this message in my notes as something to do sometimes, so at least I beat the Sunday school class to it, I guess, on this one. So where in Proverbs, see, test you a little bit, where in Proverbs does it talk about the pillars of wisdom? Anybody tell me? Okay, he's close, but he's not on. Anybody else want to try? I'll tell you here in a minute. How many pillars are there to wisdom according to Proverbs? You know that. How many pillars does wisdom have? How about Proverbs 9? Why don't you just turn to that? Proverbs 9. I'll be reading quite a bit. So my title is Seven Pillars of Wisdom. Seven Pillars of Wisdom. Now I thought wisdom would dictate that I would just say seven pillars rather than the seven pillars because it doesn't actually give us an exact list. I was reading through Proverbs 9 and actually been reading through all Proverbs, and I was being inspired and I hit this verse 1. Wisdom hath builded her house, she hath hewn out her seven pillars. I thought, now that's pretty neat. I wonder how many. So what are these seven pillars? So I kept reading and it never really just came out and said that here are the seven pillars. So I went through basically Proverbs 7, 8, and 9. Proverbs 10, the tone switches there a little bit, so that's why I didn't go into 10 much. And I tried to come up with what I would see as at least seven possible pillars of wisdom. So that's what I talk about, is seven pillars of wisdom. So we talked about wisdom. Let's talk about pillars for a minute. If I say, what's a pillar? Just tell me what is a pillar in your mind. If I say pillar, what comes to your mind? If I call you a pillar, is that a negative or a positive? Okay. Something that supports, holds a lot of weight. Any other thoughts? What is a pillar? Something steadfast, sure. Okay. Some more? Strong. So you're saying if I would call you all pillars over here, I might be okay. If I'd call them over here, they might think it has a different connotation. It sort of has the idea of big sometimes too, wouldn't it? At least possibly if I would call somebody in the wrong context a pillar, they would feel less than happy with me. Is there any other thoughts? What else do you think of in a pillar? Personally, I like architecture, so one thing I think of is these big, like you go to Washington, D.C., where they spend a little more money on their buildings than we tend to in Arkansas, or I guess the Capitol would have a lot of these too, where they have that dome and they have those pillars, columns, where they're made out of rock. So I think of something heavy, you know, strong, heavy. We use some of those. Any more?
Protection.
Protection.
And something to think of the Egyptians.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the pillar of fire there. Okay, thank you all for your help. So let's combine those two. We have wisdom, which is something at least some of us want some of the time, and we have the pillars. So that means the things that support wisdom, the things that build wisdom, the thing that keep, protect wisdom, that keep wisdom wise, shall we say. So Proverbs 9. Actually, before I read that, I was going to missed over here a little bit. How many of you were here when Richard Herr was here? It's a little over a year ago. Y'all remember him? Okay. I don't know if he used this word, but he talked about the gap. The gap. Do you all remember what the gap was? It wasn't going swimming on the first sunny day of spring. It was something else. All right, Brian?
Was it the gap between our knowledge we have
about? Yeah, I actually wasn't here, so I'm basing this on those of you that were. But he did talk to, as something he'd shared where I was as well, so I think I heard the same thing. But it's basically what he calls the gap, or my words for what he called it, is what you know as truth or what you accept as true, and yet what you actually find yourself doing, the difference between those two. I think, as I remember, what he told me was that most of our frustration in the Christian life comes from we know this, but we find ourselves doing this. And then it leads to this, shall we say, friction or problems because we know better, yet we struggle with doing what we know. So does wisdom help us with that gap? Does wisdom help us with the gap? Okay, Proverbs 9, verse 1. For most of the verses I have for you will be in the three chapters here, so just plan on staying here. Proverbs 9, verse 1 through 6. Wisdom hath builded her house. She hath hewn out her seven pillars. She hath killed her beasts. She hath mingled her wine. She hath furnished or set her table. She hath set forth her maidens. She crieth upon the highest places of the city. Whoso is simple, let him turn in hither. As for him that wanteth understanding, she saith to him, come, eat of my bread, and drink of the wine which I have mingled or mixed. Forsake the foolish, and live, and go in the way of understanding. So in Proverbs, especially for those of us that are planning to, will be studying in their Sunday school class, Proverbs over and over again personifies wisdom as a woman. And it also personifies foolishness as a woman. So in some ways you would have like, I don't know, this is poor, but you almost have like these two opposing women that are calling for this man to pay attention, to give his allegiance, to give his energy, to give his life to them in their respective things. And the one is doing it for his good. The other one is doing it for, actually ultimately, his destruction, for her own pleasure. So we're not focusing necessarily on the foolish, even though she's sort of there on the sidelines as we go through this. So as you think of that, Proverbs actually talks about that, shouting from the housetops. So you have this one woman shouting, come over here, take part of this. And the other one, come over here, we can hide off in the corner and do our thing. And it goes, especially the first couple chapters. So I'd like for you to think of life. Think of yourself. Think of people you know. Think of the different paths you've seen people take through life. Think of how differently, if you've observed much of life at all, how differently sometimes seemingly small decisions end. I know I have some friends that I think about where they're at today, and you wonder. When did that process start? And I'm not sure. I could probably spend a lot more time than I have in trying to trace back. What was the catalyst? How did they end up there? It just doesn't make sense. How do you go from being like this at one point in your life to being way out here, denying actually physical realities? How do you get there? Where do these differences start? What are the hidden things that become revealed in time? So I'd like to make a little difference here before I go further on this message. In Proverbs, the word wisdom and knowledge are used somewhat interchangeably. Sometimes, and the next time, they are not. So sometimes you could use the one word for the other word, and other times you would actually mess up the meaning. So let's look at the difference between wisdom and knowledge, at least as I will use those words. You know, does wisdom have a different starting place than knowledge? Because they are used, like I said, interchangeably in some points. I personally, and I'm not saying you have to do this, but I like to think of knowledge as simply knowing things. Just knowing things. You know, as such, knowledge would basically, you would basically gain knowledge through education and through experience. You get to know things as your school children, as you go, you study math, you study language, you study science. You gain knowledge by putting into your mind what your books, what your teacher knows. Experience, as you go through life, finally you realize that some things aren't wise and maybe other things are wise. All right, I'm talking like actions. So knowledge in that way is somewhat, and I can't say completely because that's not true, but knowledge is somewhat disconnected or detached from a spiritual experience. You can have a very knowledgeable person that is not a Christian, right? You can have a college professor that knows ever so much more about how the mind works, how to program a computer, how to build a building than what I will ever know. He's very knowledgeable. But that doesn't mean that that knowledge necessarily changes his life. I'm talking in a spiritual sense. And it's not bad. It's just that it doesn't necessarily in and of itself make a difference spiritually. And I had to think of this briefly. For example, some of you here definitely have some knowledge that I would not have. I will never attain to. For example, I'm sure Cletus knows some things about building a house. He's probably forgot more about building a house than I'll ever know, right? What about Jonas working on a vehicle? I can't pull an engine apart and reassemble it to where it works. I don't think I could. I've not tried it because it looks too dangerous. But I think, Jonas, I could probably pull it apart and take the mess to Jonas, and he might get it back together after a while. I don't know. So you see, he has some knowledge I don't, or maybe on the lady's side. I think Mariana has some knowledge on how to cook that I haven't even tried to start on. Or maybe Natalie's knowledge about sewing. And so while these people use their knowledge for God, I'm not trying to indicate they do not, they could retain their knowledge about those things and walk away from God. That's not the things that keep them a Christian. And I had to think of how this works out. So, for example, for many years, the government has been telling people that using tobacco products isn't wise. So that's knowledge. You could probably ask almost anybody that's old enough to read or watch television or whatever, is smoking good for your health? And they would say, oh, no, no. But yet there's still people that smoke, right? Just having that knowledge, I guess it's probably helped some. Maybe it's kept some from starting. But at the same time, it hasn't completely solved the problem. Just knowledge doesn't completely solve a problem. So wisdom is something different, something a bit more. I'd like for you to consider, and I'll just read these verses, Psalm 119, verse 97 through 100. Listen how he says, oh, how love I thy law. It is my meditation all the day. Through thy commandments thou hast made me wiser than mine enemies, for they are ever with me. I have more understanding than all of my teachers, for thy testimonies are my meditation. I understand more than the ancients because I keep thy precepts. So the writer here, as I read this, is saying that he's wiser than his teachers. Does it mean that his teachers have knowledge he doesn't? Does he know everything his teachers do? No. He's simply saying that wisdom is not necessarily just having a vast amount of knowledge. Wisdom is something more. He says that he has more, I think what's the word it uses, understanding than the ancients. So he's saying in some way, he's saying he's actually wiser than all the old people that have been around half of forever. How can that be? Well, again, it's not that he has more accumulated knowledge or experiential knowledge. It's simply saying that wisdom doesn't necessarily come with a collection, with an encyclopedia set. Can I say it that way? You can know everything from A to Z and still be very unwise. I'm not saying, again, I'm not trying to down knowledge. I think that's been done some in our circles to ill effect. That's not my point. I'm just saying that doesn't make you wise by itself. So in breaking down what really is wisdom then, what are some of the factors involved in having wisdom? How can I grow true wisdom then? Where does it start? How is wisdom built? What are the seven pillars mentioned? So let's look at these seven pillars. Like I said, my verses will be taken from Proverbs 7, 8, and 9, with some supporting ones from Ecclesiastes and Psalms. So the seven pillars. The first is pretty clear. We find that here just down in further in the chapter. The first has to do with fear. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So now maybe you say that's weird. So you're saying that wisdom starts with fear. Well, maybe I should clarify the word fear. This word fear basically has the same thing as in Hebrew as what a woman should do for her husband. I don't want my wife scared of me, okay? That's not what we're talking about so much as what we're talking about of being in respect and in awe of. Has a thought of honoring, of adoration, of seeking admiration from that thing or person. So in using fear in that context of thinking honor, adoration, admiration, being in respect for all of, if I use fear, that's what I mean. So may I suggest to you that all of us fear, or maybe I should say admire something or someone. Now granted, we may relate to that thing differently, right? That's not saying all our response is the same. But which one of us doesn't have some thought when we face a pretty big decision where the results will be obvious? Say I'm buying a truck. Or I am, I don't know, choosing where I will live in the future or something like that. Which one of us doesn't somewhat factor in what other people think about that? You know, the one person might say, I won't do this because so-and-so doesn't like this. That's what we call a conformist. You might have a rebellious person that says, well, I'm going to buy this because this person is this way. You know, they're still both basing their decisions on the other person, aren't they? The one is doing, is buying, well, let's just use trucks to keep it simple. The one is buying a Ford because his friend thinks Fords are the best. The other one is deliberately not buying a Ford because he knows this other fellow thinks they are the best. So he's just going to stay away from it. And you can call that an ornery streak or whatever you want. But they're still both basing their decision on what others think. So the thought process, what will others see, think, hear, of me when they hear that I did, or when they see that I did this? You know, when we have this fear of others, regardless of how we relate to it, it becomes a factor in why we do what we do. You know, Proverbs 29:25, you don't need to turn to this one, says this in regarding fearing man or desiring man's respect and admiration. It says, the fear or the desire for man's admiration bringeth a snare or a trap. I want to ask you something. If I go through life looking for admiration, respect, and honor from you all, whoever, at what point have I achieved it? It's sort of a moving target, isn't it? About the time I start feeling cozy that, well, everybody thinks well of me, guess what's going to happen to me at least? Somebody's going to come to me and say, Joe, you shouldn't have said that way. Then it sort of wipes the whole rug out, and where do you got to start all over again, right? That's where the snare comes in various ways. Plus, it's just not wise. New Testament tells us not to compare ourselves among ourselves. So I'm not saying we have a don't care attitude about other Christians especially. But finally, this doesn't totally work. But yet, as I mentioned, I think all of us faces this in some way to some degree. I don't think we can just completely say, oh, I don't care what anybody thinks. If you really say that and you really mean it, you actually might have a bigger problem than the person that cares a little bit. Okay, that sort of sounds arrogant. It sort of sounds self-sufficient. God intended us to rely on each other to some point. So the problem is not so much a problem of caring what others think, but whose opinion do I value the most, right? Isn't that what it comes down to? Whose opinion do I value the most? If I value any of your opinions more than what God would have me do, I'm going to struggle, right? Because finally, I'm looking for something from you that can only come from God. I'm not saying I should write all of you off completely. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying at the same time, if my primary thing comes from you, I'm missing and I won't be where God needs me. So in thinking, as I make decisions, as I look at the choices of life, what is my starting point? Is it what would Dad say about this? That's not all bad if you're living at home with Dad. It's good to keep him happy, right? What would Mom say about this? What's my family going to say? What's my church going to say? And again, there is a partial good in some of this. But that if that is where I start, it's a negative. Do you follow me? If that is the first question I ask, it reveals a problem in my life. My starting point should be, what would God think of this? Or how does God view this? You know, as I make up my choices, am I in awe of God? You know, if I'm really in awe of God and I desire His admiration and His blessing above and beyond all else, it's not saying that nobody else matters, but it's saying that I seek that first. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and His righteousness. And all these things shall be added unto you in that case. So what's my starting point? Do I have a desire to be and do what God would have me be and do? Am I seeking Him first and foremost as I make the decisions of life? Proverbs here tells us that this is the beginning of wisdom. Proverbs 9 verse 10. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the holy is understanding. Knowledge of the holy is understanding. You know, to please God with all that I am, with all that I have, and with all that I can ever seek to become is finally where wisdom starts. If I start anywhere else, my building's not going to hold up because I'm missing the first pillar. I'm missing the first pillar of really just fully being God's. And I had to think of this briefly, some positive examples of somebody who had the fear of God in a proper way and awe of respect was Noah. Do you think he'd have built that ark if he wouldn't have had a fear of God, an awe of God, a desire to be holy gods? No, of course not. What about Joseph? Who can sin against God and do this great wickedness? And I admire those people, Joseph and Daniel's another one. I wish I could have more of that. You know, that the whole thing that seemed to keep them from sin wasn't some logical thought process. It was standing before God and seeing that I can't please God and do this thing that I probably very much actually desired to do. They were human. I can't believe that there wasn't some appeal to the flesh in all their temptations. So bringing it back to me, how is that in my life? Is my highest motive, and it's not a feeling, but my choice to just wholly follow God. That choice that no matter what the flesh shouts at me, no matter what, back to Joseph, woman hurls herself at me, no matter what food and prestige is offered to me, thinking of Daniel, that I turn it down because of my desire for God. And maybe those are too big. I think they definitely affect, but went into even smaller things. I don't want to get too nitty-gritty. But one concern I have is, how do we make our everyday decisions? And I'm not here, this isn't my subject, but in what I say, I'm not trying to say we should void or get away from necessarily brotherhood agreements. But let's say in questionable things, within what would maybe be acceptable perimeters in our group, would things be different rather than if I was here asking the question, can I get away with this or can I reason my way to this? Or what will people think of me if they know I do this? What would it be if the question went more like this? Will I be more fully pleasing to God by doing, wearing that? And maybe take it broader into church as we think about what God would have for us as a church, as we relate to the different things that come into our lives, the choices we face, whether it's mission work, whether it's church plantings, whatever. How often is our starting point what would please God and His kingdom the most? Is that where we start, or is it what would make me most cozy? What would keep my friends around me? Where do I start? Remember, without the pillar of a fear, an admiration, a desire for God, my building can't stand. Okay, moving on to the second one. The second pillar that needs hewed out and built has to do with listening, learning, and growing. And don't raise your hands, but have you ever met anyone who knew everything about everything? Ever met one of those people? It don't matter what subject you're on, they have a lot to say on it. Oh, and they can go on and on. They know everything about everything. You know, let me ask you, who's one of the most, what, how should I say this? Who's the most foolish of all men? Is it not the man who cannot be taught anything by anyone because he already knows? Isn't that the foolishest person to be? And second, like unto it, and we have some of those in our house, and I think they must have inherited it from Dad. Are those who are so busy thinking their own thoughts and living in their own world that they don't hear instruction when it's given. You have any of those in your house? Did you say something? Well, yeah, I did. You know how those conversations go? Like I said, it starts with Dad in our house, I'm sure. That's fairly foolish, too. Because finally, oftentimes what may be said may be more important than what I was thinking anyway. thinking of instruction. So can I, or more to the point, do I listen with understanding when I'm spoken to? When I have the opportunity of being taught, do I assimilate that? Do I hear the sound? Do I not only hear the, do I not only hear the sound of the words that are spoken, but do I make those words part of me? Do I think about them? Do I see the truth or the falseness in them? And then am I willing to implement, to begin acting upon the truth that I hear? And basically, am I teachable? Here's the verse I'll read in Proverbs 7, verse 24. It says this, "Hearken unto me now therefore, O ye children, and attend to the words of my mouth." Don't you hear just the pleading in that? In the context here, it's again talking about the foolish woman, actually the adulteress. And you know, friends, this morning, if we go through life thinking that somehow we will just experience everything, and after the experience we'll come around and decide whether it was good or bad, I'd like to suggest to you that we will end in ruin. You know, my life isn't long enough, and our existence is too fragile to think that we can learn everything by experience. Finally, there are some things that have to be learned from the mistakes of other people. And that's learning, listening, learning, growing. I can't expect to have experiential knowledge on everything and survive. If I try that, I will likely miss the very best because I'm too busy experiencing the very worst. Can I learn from others? Going back to, let me read some more verses out of Proverbs 8, verse 1 through 6 now. "Doth not wisdom cry, and understanding put forth her voice? She standeth on top of the high places, by the way, in the places of the path. She crieth at the gates, at the entry of the city, at the coming in at the doors. Unto you, O men, I call, and my voice is to the sons of men. O ye simple, understand wisdom, and ye fools, be of an understanding heart. Hear, for I will speak of excellent things, and the opening of my lips shall be right things." Going back to chapter 9, verse 9, he says this, "Give instruction to a wise man, and he will be yet wiser. Teach a just man, and he will increase in learning." Jumping to Proverbs 17, verse 10, "A reproof entereth more into a wise man than 100 stripes on a fool." That's pretty hard, isn't it? "A reproof entereth more into a wise man than 100 stripes on a fool." This is sort of rough for me, but let me ask you this. Which am I? You know, the person that thinks that they have to experience something and they don't believe or learn from the mistakes and failures of others is basically a fool, because he's saying, "I have to get beaten up for this to know whether it's right or wrong." So a wise man is basically a person that when he's reproved, that's all it takes. And it's sunk in. It's, shall we say, etched on his brain more than if you beat a fool to a frazzle. It's a choice we make. So how is it with me? How is it with you? Am I teachable? Do I grow through the experience and thoughts of others? Again, if I can't learn from others talking to me, my building will not stand. Okay, moving on to the third pillar that needs hewn and erected is what is of most benefit and worth in life. In other words, value. The pillar of value. What is of most benefit and worth in life? Or maybe for most of us, maybe I shouldn't say what is most benefit and worth in life. I'm sure almost everybody here, if I would come ask you, what is of most benefit and worth in life, all of you could give different facets of very good answers, right? You might use different words, but you'd all say good things. The problem here is the test for me, at least, is sometimes what I would tell you is most valuable, I treat as less valuable. Do you do that? So I might tell you, living for God, glorifying God, giving myself wholly for God and for others. And I could maybe preach on these things and tell you all how great it is. But you know, guess what? During the week, if I don't live that way, do I really believe it? Is that wisdom? You know, the person that is obsessed with making his business grow, or the person that's obsessed with anything really outside of God, at the end of the day, there's no switch that we flip. As much as we like to pretend there is sometimes, there's not a switch that I can work 5 days a week and be consumed with my work and my business and then hit Saturday afternoon and I got to preach Sunday, so flip a switch. There is no such thing. I can pretend there is, and I can maybe fool you into thinking there is, but there is not. I am either one or the other, the Bible tells us over and over again. The other thing is, I can't be consumed with getting safe, secure, set up here in the way that suits me, where I'm comfortable and things are best, and say, well, you know, in another 10 years, I'll be willing to consider some other options. Because guess what? There's no switch to flip. I'm either one or the other. And I'm not saying that there isn't right and wrong times to do things. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying, if I live wholly for one world or another, that's the world that I'm part of. Proverbs 8, verse 10 through 11 says this, "Receive my instruction and not silver," ouch, "and knowledge rather than choice gold. For wisdom is better than rubies, and the things that may be desired are not to be compared to it." In other words, that last phrase is saying, all the things that this world can give us that look so valuable, private jets, yachts, big homes, anything you want to name, are not comparable to the value of wisdom. It's a zero. It doesn't even factor. So maybe to pull this, I don't know, my store of silver and gold and rubies is real small, to be honest with you. I almost don't associate with these terms. So let's just say this. Let's say that Monday I go to work and I meet somebody at one of the companies that we do service work for. And they say, Joe, I appreciate the work you've been doing here. We've got room for a service fellow on our staff. And I tell you what, we'll salary you at $150,000 a year. And you can have 5 weeks off spread out through the year whenever you want it. Sound like a pretty good deal, wouldn't it? But let's say that the one company I have in mind, and they didn't make me this offer, don't worry. The one place I have in mind, while those people are okay to work with momentarily, I have heard them talk to each other. And I would just have to say that to be under that influence the whole day, a regular work day, wouldn't be good for me. So let's just say I face this choice. That'd make it pretty real, wouldn't it? A gravy job, more pay than I've ever seen. Wow. But what would wisdom dictate? Proverbs 8, verse 18 through 21. Riches and honor are with me. Yea, durable riches and righteousness. My fruit is better than gold, yea, than fine gold, and my revenue than choice silver. I lead in the way of righteousness in the midst of the paths of judgment, that I may cause those that love me to inherit substance, and I will find their treasure. So what do I value? You know, each day, every day, I am showing by my life what's most valuable I am. I'm either continuing to hew out this pillar of what is most valuable and erecting it to support true wisdom, or I'm chipping away at the base of the pillar. And let me guarantee you, friends, that if we chip away at what's truly valuable in life, that building will fall, inevitably. It's like one man said, he says, Dad, he says, you can sit in your office with the door closed and think your children have no clue what you do in there. But he said, they know. They know. And sometimes, I think for what we as fathers sometimes really value, maybe becomes most clearly evident in the lives of our children. And I guess I take that as a challenge to myself as a young father. Very likely 10 years from now, you can see what was most important to me better than you can now. Is it going to be good? Okay, the fourth pillar that we need to be hewing and erecting is seeking of counsel. Actively seeking the thoughts, wisdom, and experience of others and applying them to what I face. So some of these overlap, but this is different from the learning, listening, and hearing one, in that here now I am coming to you and I'm saying, hey, I have this need, I've got this problem, I've got this decision. What do you think I should do? That is what we call seeking counsel. And it's also a pillar of wisdom. Proverbs 8, verse 14 through 16. Counsel is mine, wisdom speaking, and sound wisdom. I am understanding, I have strength. By me kings reign and princes decree justice. By me princes rule and nobles, even all the judges of the earth. So let me just ask you, does a good CEO, executive of a company, does a good judge go completely off his own thoughts and ideas to have a successful company in one hand or a successful ruling in another? No, we know they don't. In fact, you know a judge that would go out there and make decisions wholly based on his own is called a rogue judge. One of the jobs that a judge has is to know how other judges related to the same problem. And that's called precedence. And if he doesn't consider, if he doesn't consider precedence as part of the package of when he gives a judgment, his judgment is basically worthless. Because it means that the next judge up the line is going to say, well, you didn't consider this, so kick it out. Thinking of a person that runs a company. You know, the most successful man is the one who most fully utilizes the input of those around him. And I could name some. I don't know that I'll take time for it. But if you look even in a natural sense, the people who built the largest companies were generally always those who could use the input of others. Ecclesiastes 7 verse 19 says this, "Wisdom strengthens the wise more than 10 mighty men which are in a city." So he's saying that if you have a city that's surrounded by an enemy, you'd be way better off to have one wise man dropped in there by parachute than you would be 10 top fighting soldiers. How about that? So 1 to 10, that's a pretty good ratio for wisdom, isn't it? 1 to 10. So where does this wise man's strength come from? Proverbs 11 verse 14 is one of the sources. Where no counsel is, the people fall. But in the multitude of counselors, there is safety. As we come together, as we share together, you reach a better conclusion. And I want to be careful here. I'm not talking. Sometimes I see people stalling on a decision, and they're just unwilling to make a decision. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about somebody that has a decision and has every intention of making a decision, but is just asking for input. They're not waffling on it. They're just simply asking. Proverbs 15, verse 22. Without counsel, purposes are disappointed. But in the multitude of counselors, they are established. And I would like to say this about counsel. This is my personal experience and belief to some degree, even though I still struggle with enjoying this thought. That remember, usually the best counsel comes from those who think the least like me. You ever notice that? If I have a friend that thinks pretty much just like I do, his counsel is somewhat limited because he's not really going to question my conclusion. The better friend to have is the one that sort of seems obnoxious because he never agrees with you. Because whether he's right or wrong doesn't matter as much as that he will goad you into building a more sure foundation for your thought. Does that make sense? So if they just agree, well, you could go on and do it. If you find somebody that disagrees, if you're wise, you stop and say, okay. Is this valid or isn't it? If it's not valid, keep going. At the same time, consider it. When we receive counsel, especially from those dissimilar to us, it will give strength and resilience to our plans. And maybe a little bit of a humorous side illustration of this was, you remember the vet James Herriot? For those of you that ever read those stories. And one thing I always found very amusing was one time they had this huge argument, he and his boss, or I guess it was his partner maybe at that point, about where you should inject the cow. You remember that one? And the one was saying, it has to be up on the shoulder towards the neck. And on the neck there, he said, it's just the place, it's cleaner, it's better, you don't have that tail whipping around, and that is just the place to do it. And the other one said, no, you do it on the rump, right close to the tail. And he said, it's just better, you don't have to get between the cows. Anyway, I remember the story. They pretty much got huffy about this difference. And so then as the days went by, the fellow, the writer, was thinking about this. And he's like, you know, it's true. I think he was the one that did it on the rump. He decided, you know, it's true. That tail is there, and it does cause problems, and it isn't as sanitary back there. So Anyway, he went to this farm and he needed to give a cow an injection that his boss or his partner had given an injection the previous day. So he asked the man to hold the cow's tail and pull her over, and he walked up to the front there and put it in her shoulder. Ah, this was easy. It wasn't as bad as he thought. Actually, pretty good. He was just too stubborn, he guessed, to realize this. So as he was cleaning off his syringe, the farmer sort of laughed and he says, "You all vets sure do stuff different." And James was like, "Well, why is that?" He said, "Mr. Farnan was out here yesterday and he gave the shot in the rump." And James was like, "Well, maybe Siegfried wasn't the only convincing talker." But you know, the point I want to let with you is that they both were wise. I'm not saying totally, but they both could finally see the other's point of view rather than being stuck on their own. So much so that they both flipped and were still doing opposite, but at least they'd both become wise, right? I'll let that with you. Okay, the fifth pillar that we need to be working on is taking and profiting from reproof. And I think I would have enjoyed skipping this one. It's a good thing it said seven, or I would have decided that six was good enough. Taking and profiting from reproof. Let me read Ecclesiastes 7 verse 5 says this: "It is better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools." Now, I don't know about you, but generally, take this in context, but generally I would rather have somebody sing about me than come rebuke me, right? If they're singing your praises, so what? If they post a nice thing about your business review, that's great. You know, I can like this. If you said, "Oh, somebody told me about you and they really appreciate you." Oh, wow. That's a cozy feeling. And I'm not saying that that's all foolish, but at the same time, you know what does me really more good, I think, is rebuke, whether I like it or not. And I'll just be honest with you, I have yet to experience a reproof or a rebuke that just thrilled me at the time. I do. So often, somehow, when I get rebuked, and if you rebuke me, I'm not trying to say this about you, but I'm just saying this in general. So often, they seem to have come from people who are less than correct themselves. You ever notice that? Now, it seems the person quickest to tell you that you got something wrong with you sometimes is the person you're pretty sure has got a lot of wrong with them. I'm not sure I can tell you how that law of physics works there, but you know, the thing that I have trying to realize in my own life, that the way I accept or reject correction quite possibly says more about me and my character than any other one thing, regardless of that other person and their motives, right? Just forget about the person, go to God and say, "God, is there some right in here? Or is it all wrong? And help me know." Proverbs 9, verse 7 through 9. "He that reproveth a scorner gets himself a shame." And it ain't pretty. Sometimes in life, you do have to, maybe it comes with a position or something where you have to reprove somebody. And I think I know what this verse means. Person goes and speaks ill of you and makes a big thing out of it, you definitely can happen. "And he that rebuketh a wicked man getteth himself a blot." And it actually goes as far as saying, "Reprove not a scorner." I'm not quite sure how far to take that part. "Lest he hate thee." But then this is where I want to be, even though I struggle with it, is "Rebuke a wise man and he will love thee. Give instruction to a wise man and he will be yet wiser. Teach a just man and he will increase in learning." How do I respond to correction and reproof? How do I respond? And I was challenged just as recently as yesterday by a child on this one. In that a child committed what I thought was a rather grievous offense. So I did what I thought a dad should do in that situation. And what's interesting is that child probably loved me, gave me more signs of their love since that episode than they did in the previous week. And isn't that interesting? You know, can I be that way? To where if I receive correction, I could admit that it was needed. I'm sure there's not necessarily a logical thought process for the child, but to find security. And, you know, I think that's one thing that we lack a lot in our Mennonite circles, is finding, can I say, security in correction. I don't know exactly sure how we can go about fixing that, but at least I want to try to start with me. It's pretty serious if I'm the one that brings shame on the one that's trying to help me, or I bring a blot upon him. Because basically, Proverbs says to just let such a person go. Psalm 141 verse 5 says this: let the righteous smite me, and it shall be a kindness. Let him reprove me, it shall be an excellent oil, which shall not break my head. I thought maybe David felt like it would too some days, because I know I felt that way, but it says it's not gonna break your head. Okay, pillar 6 to wrap some of these up. So taking our tools to pillar number 6, I have obedience to authority and truth. Just want to read Proverbs 7, verse 1 through 5, the first part of verse 5. My son, keep my words. Lay up my commandments with thee. I put them in a safe place. Keep my commandments and live, and my law as the apple of thine eye. Bind them upon thy fingers. Write them upon the table of thine heart. Say unto wisdom, thou art my sister, and call understanding thy kinswoman. And that they may keep thee. I'll just stop there. It goes on talking about the foolish again. I had to think of the Christ parable where he talked about these two sons and the father asked him to go work in the vineyard. Remember what the one said? He says, I go, sir. But he didn't go. And I think that parable, if I may say so, falls directly on those of us who have grown up with truth. We know that we should be working in the vineyard. And we know what that includes, or at least to some extent. And so we pretend to work in the vineyard. But sometimes, to be honest, I'm afraid at least I never get there. I might be inspired and I say, oh yeah, that's great, that's good, and I'm momentarily thrilled, and oh yes, I'm going to do this. I go, sir. But where am I 10 months later? Am I still doing Joe and his thing? Or am I living for God? Proverbs 8, verse 32 to 33. Now therefore hearken unto me, O ye children, for blessed are they that keep my ways, to stay in it. Hear instruction and be wise and refuse it not. I'd like to read a couple verses from Psalm 119. Listen closely. Psalm 119, verse 169 through 176. Let my cry come near before thee, O Lord. Give me understanding according to thy word. Let my supplication come before thee. Deliver me according to thy word. My lips shall utter praise when thou hast taught me thy statutes. My tongue shall speak of all thy words, for thy commandments are righteous. Let thine hand help me, for I have chosen thy precepts. I have longed for thy salvation, O Lord. The law is my delight. Let my soul live, and it shall praise thee. Let thy judgments help me. I have gone astray like a lost sheep. Seek thy servant, for I do not forget thy commandments. You know, it's so easy to say, I go, sir. I will obey. We emphasize obedience, right? After all, isn't that sort of who we are, this thing of obedience? Yet do we really? And not, I think too often, maybe those of us that do obey, we stop with that. As I read those verses in Psalms, I was challenged all over again just to be delighted to be obedient. You realize? Just the delight in being obedient and living for God. Okay, moving on to the final, seventh pillar that completes our building support. The one I have is patience and perseverance. Patience and perseverance. Proverbs 8, verse 34 and 35. Blessed is the man that heareth me. Wisdom speaking again. I'll just repeat the phrase. Blessed is the man that watcheth daily at my gates. Blessed is the man that waiting at the posts of my doors. For whoso findeth me findeth life and shall obtain favor of the Lord. Think about that. Watching daily at my gates. Just keeping on. Waiting at the posts of my doors, just waiting for those doors to open so that we can be right for the day. I think this is another one of my besetting sins, is how often are a lack of patience and anger linked together? You ever notice that? When do people think I'm angry? It's generally when I would say, well, I'm not feeling very patient, right? You ever notice that? I found some verses here I just challenged with. Proverbs 14, verse 29 says, he that is slow to wrath is of great understanding. But he that is hasty of spirit exalteth folly. Ecclesiastes 7, verse 8 and 9. Better is the end of a thing than the beginning thereof. And the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Be not hasty in thy spirit to be angry, for anger resteth in the bosom of fools. You know, so often we may be ever so right in so many ways, but if we can't patiently wait for God to open the door, and we can stand and waiting at that door to open rather than trying to pry it open with a pry bar, however you go about it, it doesn't work. How often do we mess up God's plans because we aren't patient? You know, what happens if I would give my wife a rosebud that just was barely started to open, and she would say, well, I want an open rose right now, so she'd take some tools and try to layer that thing open. What would happen? It'd be ruined, wouldn't it? What would happen if you saw a chick hatching or a butterfly trying to crawl out of its cocoon and you help it? You know what happens? Almost always those things die. And so one thing I'm trying to speak to myself is, can we just wait on God in the things that we don't understand, in the things that don't make sense? Because the chances are, God has a plan there, but maybe he's just saying, let me open it so that it can really be what it was created to be. So how many of us are wise? Is there a gap? Is there a difference between what I know and what I do? And what am I doing about it? I would like to suggest to you that if we implement these seven pillars, it's going to help close that gap. You know, what gives strength and security and beauty to our life? It's wisdom. How do we attain, how do we get wisdom? By following, by building these seven pillars. You know, what pillars does the structure of my life rest on? Are they the pillars of wisdom? I guess I would just ask this, may all of us in all that we do begin with a reverential awe of God and end in patient perseverance in well-doing till he calls us home. Let's kneel for prayer.